back to At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Sleigh bells ring, are you listening? In the lane, snow is glistening. A beautiful sight, we're happy tonight. We're walking in a winter wonderland. And gone away is the bluebird, but here to stay, stay, stay is a new bird. He sings a love song as we go along. We're walking in a winter wonderland.
Well, you know, when you're in Tucson, in the meadow we can build. It is kind of a wonderland with the Saguaros and I think I've described it in years past as kind of a moonscape. It's always amazing when you come to Arizona, and it's just so different here. The desert landscape, and even the drive down from Phoenix to Tucson, it gets different because there's a name for it, the little mountain start to raise. I mean, then it, you know, it's very hilly down here by comparison to Phoenix. So there, Dick is back with us. This town, and when Hammer comes back, and when we talk to the students, and Robert Hartman, the program director, of course, coming up as well. Students come from all over the country, and not just all over the country; they're from all over the world. So it's an unusual and unique, unique place, and you know, the program itself. And Dick, you've been coming to this as long as anybody, right?
I think it's 20 years.
There you go.
I think so. So it's what Alan was talking about. There was a point when it was here, and literally every track owner would be here. And they'd have these big, you'd see people like in the evening, and they're all dressed in formal wear, and there's some gala going on, which clearly I wasn't invited and wasn't going to go anyway. But I mean, it really got all the movers and shakers. Then it kind of, I don't know, kind of slid down to mid-level managers and stuff like that. And then lately it seems to be way on a comeback, and the amount of people attending and all that, the exhibitors, is way up. So I know Robert's doing a good job getting some energy back into it, and seems to be going well. The program does well. The people are all over the United States in various jobs, and that's working out, because we need people. We need help.
Sal Sinatra, and Hammer, come with Sal, and you got a few minutes?
Yeah,
absolutely. Keith Oshel and Jill Byrne. Suddenly it's a quorum.
Pass these around, because I want you to discuss.
I want you to discuss that, your project, which people are more and more excited about and interested in.
Which one?
The weight classification the claiming alternative project. Yeah, you're ready. You're sure you're. Well, you got to. All right. Well, all right. Oh, you have a You got the presentation? Oh, okay. All right. So maybe, right? Then put the headset on. It'd be a little easier to discuss, right? For 5 minutes.
Oh,
yeah.
I went on a recruiting trip, and you know, it's not like walking around a racetrack. Here, you can run into anybody and everywhere. So, saw a couple people that are favorites of mine, Jill Byrne and Sal Sinatra, and actually going to kind of keep with the theme of. So we just had Alan Foreman on, and he was going on about. Some HISA stuff, and then we went into the Maryland situation and how that's they're on the last process of trying to find their, or they got their train and track selection down to two, and they're going to make that selection pretty soon. And then once Maryland gets settled, I asked them, you know, you're obviously Maryland's going to work with Colonial and schedule. And I said, well, you know, there's a few other tracks in the region, Delaware and Parks and Monmouth. And I know Sal, you know, Sal and I worked together at Monmouth for years. And, God, that's 35 years ago. We've been talking about trying to, gosh, can we just sit down at the table and work out some kind of circuit where everyone's, you know, they're everybody's horses. Not everybody's running at the same time, but they're still training and they're able to ship around and you know, and share the wealth a little bit. And,
yeah, you know, a better show for the players and the fans.
And that's what I think we've gotten away from is that we need to do this for the horse players.
Well, exactly. Short fields and, you know, the smaller foal crop and so much racing all happening at the same time in a concentrated area. There's just not enough horses to, you know, make competitive fields.
And everybody's writing the same kind of book.
Exactly.
You know, so we're all struggling for the same horse, and it's kind of silly.
You know, even when we were at Monmouth in the 90s, mm-hmm. if a three of them didn't go, you know, and then there was one down at Philadelphia Park, they'd call up, we'd just give them the horses. Here, take them. Because we, you know, that was a long time ago.
You want the horsemen to run because yes. they have to earn to keep, you know, and you want the good races to go. You know, a couple of times I proposed a centralized racing office here, especially in the Mid-Atlantic.
Yes.
Right.
You know, first of all, it's very hard to find quality staff, you know, 10, 12 officials at all these tracks at the same time.
Yeah, you know, and especially when you look at Colonial, you know, running a shorter meet. Obviously, this year we're going to be up to 44 days. But, you know, those shorter meets and trying to get staff to come to the area, you know, when they've, you know, maybe have, you know, somewhere else where they're living, and it's hard, it's expensive, it's costly.
And they
costly.
Have to work so many hours to get benefits.
Exactly.
So they don't get benefits. So there's a lot in play there.
No, it's exciting with Maryland and Virginia. Yes. Now working together again with Churchill Downs and the Maryland group getting together and realizing, you know, that got to join forces. Maryland and Virginia used to work together, mm-hmm. I gather. Yeah. Back yeah. in the day, I guess Maryland would shut down
yep.
when Colonial Downs ran, and they would send all the staff down
exactly.
to run Colonial.
Yes.
So it was a great kind
yeah,
of relationship.
It's not just the racing office. You got the gate crew, you got the valet.
Right.
The valets,
I mean, it's a lot of people to find.
Mutual tellers. I mean, it's yeah. just, it's tough.
The days of, you know, putting your stuff in the back of the car and driving to the next track and finding an apartment to live for 3 or 4 months and doing that again, you know, a couple times a year, those days are over.
It's too tough.
And as a racetrack operator, you know, you're paying stipends for people, you're
right.
paying the travel, and it's tough, but also, you know, you want to get the best crews in there because you need, you know, the
yeah.
best people to take care of the horses and the athletes. And
that was kind of like when I took racing office because that's my expertise. I thought, okay, you only really need a handful of key personnel. That's your group, you know, and then the entry clerks, if you want to call them, could be centralized to help everybody. So maybe the 5 or 6 that remain get a little more money because you can hold them or give them more responsibilities. And I just think in the economic climate that we're all living in and trying to find people, it's time to share some services to try and save everybody and get the best.
Well, and now it's so much easier because you can do everything online.
Zoom.
You know, it's not like back in the old days.
No,
when,
that's
and, you know, I think back to quote the old days. We're only talking 20 years ago, and I think when COVID came, it was that final online, and it just made it to where people don't have to be not just our world in every world. They talk here about, you know, the government buildings they're 80% empty, and I personally miss the agents walking around, and I miss all the stuff going on that it's all done online. And so on one hand it's good, but now we need to take advantage of that because there aren't the
Yeah, you miss the personal interaction with a lot of that, but at the same time, if it benefits, like Sal was
right.
saying, you know, getting more horses in more races and mm. also helping racetrack operators with the costs of running racing.
And like Sal said, the officials that we do hire, it's a career now.
Yeah.
You don't have to. I mean, there were, you know, days when we start, you were in the office and there was, you know, 10 people in there and you were, God, I hope Larry doesn't come back so I can move into his position type of thing.
Yes.
We don't have that anymore. And
we hope that comes back to fill the spot.
Yeah, too often, you know, we'll get a young prospect who will come up and they're there for a year or two and, you know, okay, where do I go next? We don't have that progressive program. and they'll leave to become a jocks agent or, you know, go sell horses or do something else. So if we had those experienced people, we could offer them a career, and they would become so much sharper. You would still have the racing office, the racing secretaries at the tracks, sure, deciding what races were going to go. But if all the entries came to a separate hub, and you could have from the third at Delaware to the second at Philly Parks, I think.
No, it helps the horsemen because you know the game they play, especially in the Mid-Atlantic. How many you got in your race because they got a race over here,
exactly,
and then we're looking at each other's books. Well, you know what? If everybody's on the same entry schedule, like you said, like Breeders' Cup, okay, Virginia closed first, but there's a Maryland horse in there. It says number two. That's the second preference. First preference is race at Maryland. The Maryland race don't go. He goes to Virginia.
Right.
You know, it's just save a lot of aggravation, but help people, owners too.
Yeah.
The trainers will tell you, if the race don't go, they cringe because their owners are online finding races for them to go to.
Right.
Which may not be in their interest, you know.
Right. But exactly what you said too about getting more this young generation that we hope is coming up into this industry, is getting them the opportunities into these positions and realizing that there is a career path for them in the racing industry. You don't just have to ride horses, own horses, that part of it. Yeah. All the different areas in this industry that they could be a part of, and with their knowledge of the technology. And I think there's a really good place for all of these younger horse enthusiasts, but we have to help them along the way and let them realize the opportunities that are out there.
Yeah, and you know, Sal and I have talked about some of this stuff for years. Of as much as we hate the lessening of the, you know, the talking to people all day, we used to say it's horse racing, but it's a people business, and it still is. But as we modernize, we're hoping to get, you know, instill the trainers to go online now and enter their horses, you know, check their workouts, check, you know, maybe a HISA alert that this horse is coming up to a 100-day, 150-day thing where I have to go get my horse looked at by a vet, where everything's done in their own little portal where they go in and they check. And while they're on there, hey, the condition book could come out and they could enter, you know, races for the whole book, put some races in. And put some horses in, and that way, you know, the racing secretary comes in that day and, hey, maybe there's three races already filled. Type of thing. So there's a lot of things that the game is evolving, and we need to stay on top of it and not just rely on our old systems of doing things. It's just not feasible.
No, and it really isn't, what do you want to call it, the best way of using resources. It really is not.
Because there's so many positions where you actually have to be physically there.
Yeah.
So if you can make, you know, some where you don't have to actually be.
Also, I think if you take the handful, let's just say, okay, you need a clerk of scales, you need a paddock judge or an identifier. Okay, these are your key positions. But do you really need that group in the office that's answering the phones in the afternoon and taking entries? Probably not. Probably not. And a lot of jobs over time never got redefined. For instance, and I hate to pick on people, but a horse identifier doesn't flip lips anymore, doesn't pull papers, doesn't write wins on paper.
So let's go back and talk about what you just said, flip lips.
Yeah.
So
most people probably wouldn't even understand.
And that's what I meant. That's where I'm dead.
Sorry.
No, we're at the university. You got to start low. So every horse that runs in a race at any track has to be identified, and it's not like, oh yeah, that looks like the four horse in this race. Every horse gets that. Has a tattoo number and it's placed inside their lip, and it starts with a different letter, corresponds with a different year, but it might be M45678, and on their official papers, that number better match the papers along with the markings. And when a horse comes over, there's a person horse ID that literally flips the lip, reads the tattoo, and he moves on.
Yeah, so now they scan it.
Now they have a chip.
Yeah, they
it's
scan
all digital.
It,
and it's digital,
up,
right.
All their identification comes up on an iPad. And
so that alone proves that we are moving along.
Right.
That, yes, that was a big step
forward. But some of those jobs now are streamlined.
Yes.
It's not as...
You know, paddock judges today, it's blinkers on, blinkers off. You know, back when we were taught, it's every piece of equipment. And when a horse gets claimed, you would put that on the slip for the new trainer. This horse runs in a D-bit. And it was a kind of a just like a courtesy to the new trainer. They knew what that horse ran with when he claimed him. We don't do that anymore. You know, there's little things that were appreciated in the past that just gone by the wayside. You know, we don't have shoe boards. Have we tried some shoe boards anymore?
Which doesn't mean all of those things that we all kind of grew up around the racetrack with is great, but we have to be modernized in today's system and the way it works, and to the point of getting new people interested in this industry. Mm-hmm. And those are some of the ways that they can definitely get involved. But we still don't want to lose the personal part of it. Because I know Rick, you and I were talking last night.
Yeah.
It's like, we're a racetrack family. We're all in competition with each other. We're a racetrack family, as dysfunctional as we may be, like all families. But to lose the personal, some of the personal interaction would certainly take away from, to me, what this, means.
Yeah, but I'm still, again, where we all huddled in the racing offices, entries are going on. People need to be out in the barn area.
Right. You don't need everybody in there answering phones.
No, and you can have a cup of coffee on the rail.
Mm-hmm. Talk.
And enjoy and talk to somebody and actually be working, not realize it. You see a horse gallop by, it maybe looks funny, or you see something wrong going on, you see it.
Or you're talking to a trainer out on the rail and start talking about a certain horse. Well, we have a race coming up.
Yeah, I'll write one for you. What?
And when this came up, Encompass talked about this 10 years ago, and that was my big concern, and said, no, we need to talk to these guys. And then I realized, a guy puts a couple horses, it doesn't mean you're going to call him up and say, hey, I see you put a couple in. Don't you have another one? It actually instills conversation rather than not. And, what racing offices go to, they still go through it. Literally, when they're looking for horses for a race, will go through old charts, obviously, and look for similar races and see if their horse fits. And that's probably still going to happen where you do have to talk to them, because you're constantly calling them for a rider or, an owner not being licensed or something.
Yeah,
so
technology does make people stupid, too. you think back of reading proof and knowing everybody's silks and, marking the chart book, comment what the trainer gave you out of the horse on the shelf or whatever. So the next guy looking for him, now we're going to the computer. Nobody writes that in there. Nobody.
Thanks to that, I don't remember numbers or anything anymore.
Yeah, nobody knows anybody's phone number. It's in your phone. Otherwise, you don't know how to call somebody.
If I ever lost my phone, yeah. I...
For going back, talking about phone numbers and before these...
Phone.
You are as good as your phone book.
Yes.
And so in the Mid-Atlantic area, when everyone's fighting for the same horses, I kid Sal had a picture the other day I wish you could bring out. There was 12 of us in the office, all guys. We each had a counter of about maybe 3 feet. I said we had a phone book, and an ashtray.
Yeah.
And, we all smoked back. They were sitting next to each other puffing away. And you would call. Now, if we were looking for Jill Byrne, well, guess what? She's not at the barn. You know what? I know where she gets her hair done.
Yeah.
And you would call them we would call people at their dentist, at their, wherever you could. And whoever beat you, to the punch, that's what we had. So you didn't give that number away. If somebody said, hey, can I get that number? No, that's my number.
That was your way of hustling. But it was also a great way of communication, too.
Yeah.
So kind of getting back to now, current and future. And I think, it really is a very big positive step, the Maryland-Virginia collaboration. Obviously, Maryland has some things going on where, they have to cut back a bit on dates. And this is the perfect opportunity to get this kind of circuit going again, work together with everybody. So, commending both sides there, Churchill, the Maryland group, for doing this. But, again... going forward, you have all these other tracks running at the same time within, a couple hundred mile radius of each other.
Basically, and, way, way back, when I was at Parks, we tried doing it with Monmouth. Mm-hmm. Monmouth has a summer. Parks should, Haskell should be, not run against by Parks. And we tried with Delaware. Maybe Delaware could bookend a Laurel meet or a Pimlico meet. Yeah, I think if we all sat in a room, we're pretty reasonable people. And you kind of know which tracks certain months are theirs, and we should hold them as holy as a group. And how do we help each other? Because if, you know, it's VA Derby Day, that's a big day in Virginia. I can make money on those races if I promote it from Maryland or Pennsylvania.
Right. Let everybody have their special day. Right. And the bottom line benefiter is the horse player.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because the fields are bigger and more competitive. And that's where we need to keep in mind. Yes.
And that money circles back in. And that's where, you know, you have to look at the bigger picture of the simulcast market, mm-hmm. and, you know, all of that kind of funding, indirect and direct funding, to purses, to the horsemen, to understand, you know, from a racetrack perspective, ownership perspective, of how it can balance out. Because initially they don't want to shut, you know, close races for certain days because you lose, you know, certain simulcasts. But I think we're at a point now we're backed into a bit of a corner of...
And if we can all make enough money to keep our barn areas open to help each other, because that's really the biggest problem for the horsemen, is they want to make sure they don't have to move and all that. And I get that. Mm-hmm. It's expensive. So, you know, if they're training at their local facility, but they have opportunities elsewhere and they're confident that the races will go, that's another problem we have. You know, it helps the whole ecosystem, if you will.
Speaking of that, we have a program that we're working on, maybe we'll in the next couple of days that we'll talk about to do that.
Because ultimately, if you look at HISA, the health and welfare of the horse, I always say begins with its schedule, just like any athlete. You have to have confidence that, okay, I'm working this horse, this race in 3 weeks, it's going to go. And when it doesn't, then you're, you know, if the extra pops up somewhere or before it, your horse is off sync when you enter in that race, in my opinion.
Well, in today's ownership groups, too, you know, you have all these kind of big syndicates. You have people in business to answer to about the cost of keeping a horse, racing a horse. And it's a little bit of a different mindset than it was, you know, 30 years ago when you had the DuPonts and the Whitneys mostly were your stables. As a, you know, sport of kings, now it's business.
Yeah.
And businesses have to make money.
And it's a very thin line of margin business.
I mean, yes.
You can't afford to skip months of training and not racing.
Yeah, even though the purses are big, if you can't run for it, it doesn't matter.
It doesn't do you any good.
It's another thing that's evolving that we're trying to get across to some. Less is more, and in this case, less choice of races to run in and make them, you know, make those races go on a timely manner.
And I think you and I discussed it. I think also the way we actually pay the purse out. I mean, right now, okay, 60, 20, 11, 6, and 3, and most trainers are looking to be 6 or 7 only because there's less horses to be.
Right,
to
so like Sal's whipping off those numbers. Those are percentages of the 100% of the purse, usually 60 to the winner, 20, and then, you know, 12, 6, and 2, or some semblance of that. Normally the first 5 get paid. If there's 5 horses in the race, 5 get paid. If there's 12 horses in the race, 5 get paid.
But now that's changing at a lot of racetracks. They're paying back to last a minimum number.
Some are paying like to cover
costs.
A quota participation fee that'll cover maybe the jock's mount and the LASIK shot or the shipping.
Right.
But Sal has a concept which makes sense. Well, if I finish fifth in a 5-horse field, I didn't beat anybody, and I still get my money. And what if I finish fifth in a 12-horse field? I beat 7 horses. Shouldn't I get paid more than that? So in other words, maybe there's a system out there to pay you for how each horse you beat, in a sense. So the big, larger the field, maybe you make a little bit more money than the 5-horse field.
Yeah.
With horses only running 6 or 7 times a year and the expense of training, you know, those 6 or 7 swings that we get with the horse, they need to earn their keep, if you will, or to keep people afloat. And it doesn't work that way. Most horses in the 6 or 7 starts are not going to win 2, or, you know. And
the only thing to be careful, to me, just looking at being careful about with these kind of participation and incentive bonuses, you have to really have your checks and balances of making sure horses aren't running just
for money,
just to get that money that, you know, that horse. And now with, you know, the way the vets examine horses and with the red flags that come up through, you know, HISA or other, and committees that get together when all the entries come in and look, and if they see something, you know, they can make that decision. But
no doubt,
that's the only negative.
And I think that goes into what edging on is, you know, we've done that proposal with the
let's ask this gentleman here if he would be in favor of something like that. I'm serious. Eric, give it a microphone. Eric Hamelbeck, the head of the National HVPA, the Horsemen's Group. We were just discussing here about the payment of purses. Traditionally, you know, 70, 20, 12, 6, and 2, whatever that may be. So, in other words, if you finish, the example I use, if you finish fifth in a 5-horse field, you got what you get. If you finish fifth in a 12-horse field, you got the same amount. And we discussed maybe a possible formula where you got paid by how many horses you beat. In other words, if you finish fifth and beat 7 horses, maybe you got a little bit more. And maybe the purses were you're going to pay 105% on that type of race because the field's bigger. Just in other words, just trying to expand on that where I'm paying more of a purse. Yeah, but the field's bigger, so you're getting a bigger return on the wagering dollar as well. So you understand where we're going with this?
I do. I mean, I have to admit, you guys have hit me out of the blue.
We did with
only one cup of coffee yet this morning, but
we knew you could handle it.
No, it sounds like an interesting formula to review because at the end of the day, you want to be able to have an incentive to be in the race. Period. So Sal and I think my very first conference I ever spoke at was with Sal, and it was on how do we get more horses entered, and that was 2015, and we're still talking about it. So, so that brings an incentive. But I will say, and what's kind of caused the pause in my voice, we've also been accused as horsemen for just entering horses to get a purse, right? So I have some pause, and I'd like to see the formula and the reasoning, because it was very clear at a track in Kentucky that, they kind of came out with, well, we're not going to pay till last because we don't want people entering horses, but again, the monies that are paid out to that position, maybe you pay the jock's mount, the Lasix fee, etc. It's not like you paid enough, and that was at least the exaggeration that people were just sticking horses in just to get a check, and that's completely erroneous, in my opinion, Jill.
We just said the same thing. With all the checks now, with the vets, you can't just stick a horse in it.
I know, and that's a good thing. It really is, from that example. But when you have organizations that still accuse that,
right?
That's where rules from perception start being developed, and that's lack of horsemanship. And so to me, that's an important side of it. But I understand the point that you and Sal are making, and certainly would want to look at that and review it. Because, again, anything we can do to add field size is going to be very important to all of us. I mean, we saw that with the Claiming Crown. I mean, 11.8 horses in per field. I mean, when does that happen? You know, average number of starts, 26 for the horses that were in there. Yeah. So you want that side of the racing to always be there.
Right.
And there's always going to be a limit on graded stakes because that's a limited population. But the rest of the fields, we need to get up there in size. Yeah. And whether it's condition changing or I know the discussion around the rating system, I think it's all very good dialogue because at the end of the day, we've got to have something, whether it's shortening the number of races nobody wants to do that either, but we need to have something that we can get more horses in to increase the field size.
Right, and I think we all agree on that.
Absolutely.
For some reason, I don't know, that was
never been a
big deal, but we all agree with that, and there's we have to try some things, and not everything's going to work, but we really do. We mentioned, offering less choices for the trainer. I always said, if you offer them 3 choices, they're going to take the third one.
Right.
As far as the date one goes,
right.
But if you give them one, they're going to enter in it, but they have to have the confidence so that when they enter, that race is going to go.
Yeah, and I think that's become one of the largest conversations is, especially when you add on the vet inspections and everything related to getting into a race, is the condition book falling apart, none of the races go, we've prepared this horse for, X number of weeks to get to this race, and boom. Not enough entries to go, and so you're back on the shelf. The extra doesn't come back around for another 2 to 4 weeks, and or in some of the shorter meets, the race just you never see it again. So, that part to me, and I know Sal and I really agree, you know, some of the conditions that are written today. I always laugh and say that the chestnut that broke from the three hole on Wednesday, non-winners of two, you know. So, you know, that sort of thing, opening up the conditions, I do think should help with that. Less choices. So
exactly, and that's part of the reason we're experimenting, or we're going to discussing about the ratings, where your horse gets a number, and there's a race for your number, and you just go in without, you don't have to think about it. That's where I'm running.
Yeah.
And so the pluses and minuses of that, but I think we're headed down the road the right way for a change. Everyone agrees. So we're going to have a discussion later in a couple hours with you know, some racing people, and go over some of these points again. So it's actually people are shaking their head this way, you know, instead of going, oh, you know what, well, we don't need to do that. You know, it's not, hey, we're doing fine, so we don't care about them anymore. Everybody realizes we're all in this together.
Right.
And yeah.
Well, let me get Mr. Knee back down here.
Thanks, Aunt.
Didn't
mean to have you. But I knew Eric could handle it. He's seen a curveball or two.
Yeah, that was like an ambush.
That's all right. Well, it wasn't a setup.
No, but that's so true. You know, what he said, what we're all saying is we all have to realize that, you know, even though we're competitors competing for horses, in the end, at the stage we're at right now in this industry, we are in the same boat. And if we don't paddle all in the same direction, we're not going to have much left out there. I hate to sound like doom and gloom, but I do also see what you're saying is our heads are nodding more positively now because of things like that working forward.
So, and it takes some people to have some off the wall ideas and not be afraid to try it. So many people in position of authority, I use the word, corporate quicksand, where good ideas go and they never come out. But you can't be afraid to fail.
No,
you have to try something and massage a few things and make it work. So
and we have the public perception that we're actually trying.
Right.
They see it. They see the smaller fields and complain about it, and they don't see anything new being tried.
Right.
Yeah. We're running. I know they want to knock everything. For a lot of people on social media, they knock everything. But unless you're trying, at least they have that feeling that we get what they're saying. They may not like, but we try.
Yeah, and get some new ideas out there, fresh ideas.
Yes.
We don't need to always, you know, get the same ideas from the same old guard.
No, and as a fan and racehorse owner myself, I don't even watch races anymore, which is sad to say. And, you know, it used to be a hobby, you know, Rick.
Yeah.
A group of us would go to OTB and kill a Saturday afternoon and throw our money on the table and just gamble. And that's not there anymore because you go there and it's like, okay, like a five horses here, four here, three to five shots. And then the CAWs come in. That's another story.
That will come up later.
Yeah, it sucks the fun out of it.
And so we need that up.
We have to get the fun back in racing, only for our fans, our guests, our gamblers, but for those of us in it. It has to be fun because it's a lot of work. It's hours and hours of dedication.
But,
so we have to get the fun back in it.
But we didn't see it as work.
No,
it was our life. We enjoy it. We enjoy the people. We enjoy the horses.
It's all.
And
it's still not work.
Anyway, it's good. It's good to be able to just talk about these ideas, and hopefully, you know, some of them will take, and I think they will. But it just takes a little push.
That's it,
right, Steve?
I got a question, sir. No, keep it on.
Sal, I wanted to ask you a question that has not gotten, that got a little bit of notice. It was kind of an inside baseball topic, and this kind of goes back to your Equibase experience. Ooh. The concerns over char callers not being on site. How big of a story is this? I mean, I think a few people, you know, took issue with it, but it kind of popped up on the radar and disappeared pretty quickly.
Yeah, I got a few phone calls from some of my friends that are char callers when that rumor came out. And from being at the Jockey Club and working with Equibase, first of all, it's a very difficult job to get qualified chart callers moving around. As we were just talking about, horsemen moving around and officials moving around. Charcoalers got to move around, and clockers. It's very hard to find these people.
So once again, I'm taking it back down. Explain what a charcoaler is. So why it's such a difficult job.
Well, you normally it was two. Now we're down to one. Baker tracks have two. But, you know, they're watching the race. They're calling into their tape. They're rewatching. They have to write the comments on it. They got to write the margins on it. They have a good ones have a great eye for trouble. Some of them like to gamble, which is I have no problem with because it gives them a better eye of the race. They're watching the race differently than just, okay, this is the position. But in those far-off places, small meets, it's very hard to get a qualified person. So do you put somebody in there and get bad data, or do you tape the race to somebody who can do a four of these little tracks? That's the concept.
And do it off TV rather than live.
If you have the right camera angles, and I think the data would be better in those cases, but I wouldn't want to see it at Naira or Gulfstream or, you know, Colonial. Big meets that people want to see those comments. The comments and the chart caller, people don't give them enough credit. They really don't. A good chart caller, and you can read the footnotes, you can see who's better than others in some cases. Yeah. You know, some people just like to write. You'll see the footnote at Naira is the size of the chart. You know, in some places it's a couple words for each horse.
Well, there's some editorialism that goes on, editorializing that can be a part of it, which is okay. It's a viewpoint. And you know, certainly you don't need to defend if there's chart callers that are betting. In fact, it's a positive, to my way of thinking, that you know that we've got people who understand the perspective of the horse players. I mean, this is, you know, that data, the importance of that data, the accuracy of the charting, the accuracy of the margin calls. It's what everybody is then using to make their decisions on subsequent starts. And so when players get upset and are critical of mistakes, and there are mistakes, and I think the people that were concerned about taking the caller out of the press box and having them be central, I don't think being on site is a necessity necessarily for accuracy.
Maybe not for accuracy, but I don't know. You watch a race live and you watch it on TV, you see it two different ways, in my opinion. You know,
it's interesting.
When you see a good, and when you work upstairs, when you see upstairs as like a placing judge, when you're, you know, coming up through the ranks, and the chart caller's there, and you go over and watch them call. I mean, they're literally they're like a race announcer. You know, the 1x2, 7x3, the gray horse is up in front by 6, and those are the numbers that they're writing down that you're reading in the form, and they'll go back and readjust them. But you get a better feel when you're doing it live.
Well, he may be listening. Normally, he would be here. And I don't know if his assignment as a Kentucky race caller allows Mitch to come be here. But an alumnus, Mitch Downs, Mitch, he didn't necessarily come to Arizona to end up as a chart caller. He wanted to work with animals. He wanted to work in training, and he was an assistant. He ended up working for Todd Pletcher for a period, but he worked for Chuck. But he ended up in that arena, and I get to see him do it at Kentucky Downs. And it's so much fun to watch and listen, you know, as he's, especially at a place like Kentucky Downs, where it's as challenging probably a venue and an oval as there is anywhere, you know, in the American game. You know, and it's funny for speaking of which, for all of the carrying on about the rest of the world being so much better, they don't have any chart calling in most, right? I mean, Dick, where else is chart calling done to any degree the way it is?
Sorry, Hong Kong does electronically with sectional timing and things like that.
With a chip?
That works out real well. But yeah, it's us. Here's the crazy thing with us. We are per capita the smallest bettors in the world. We have 350 million citizens and we bet 10, 11 billion. And yet other countries with way less betting, way more. Japan with 120 million people betting 30-something billion. So even though we all say we want the data, so to speak, I don't know how much it really helps. I think people get reliant on it. Then when they don't have it, they don't know what to do. If you learn how to watch races and learn how to look at colors and sleeves and caps and things like that, maybe you wouldn't need all the graphic packages and things like that. That's just me. That's the old guy, you know, get off my lawn. But I still think it's relevant.
You know, we actually at Colonial last year had a RTIP recent graduate, Nathaniel, was the chart caller for there. And he absolutely loved it. And here's somebody who he also worked, you know, did some work in events and things. But, you know, he wants a career in track announcer. He wants a career in this industry. So if we can offer them, you know, all these different positions to learn more about the entire way, you know, that racing operates and goes, that was a perfect example. But I also think, you know, there's two sides to being live. There's nothing like watching a race live, no matter, you know, if you're a fan, if you're betting, right, if, you know, you work there. But from having all the different camera angles and televisions right in front of you, you may get a more accurate, you can go back, rewind, you know, look at everything over and over again. But, yeah, live is still the best.
I just want to add something. During COVID, announcers weren't able to cover games the way they did. So I love watching La Liga, Spanish soccer, in the afternoon. And the calls were coming out of Miami. They were not on site. And the technology was good enough that they're in front of a screen calling the race. I think they factored in like a little bit of a delay. So they weren't calling it precisely live. But it was, you wouldn't notice it as a fan. And it was very dramatic, and you'd never know they weren't at the game and stuff. Because finally, one of the announcers actually got to go to Barcelona. And you think, wait a minute, this guy's been calling these games for years now. He'd never been there. So it can be done. Technology is better. Super high def, 8K is better. You know, just things like that. And hopefully, with the drone technology and everything else, We don't necessarily need that high perch for the pan shot, and we can have other ways of televising racing.
Yeah, you bring up a good point. I mean, the drone, a few tracks are using it now, and it's an interesting angle to begin with. Forget about everything else. You get a totally different perspective of the race and the space between and everything else.
After the race, not during the race.
Everybody's fearful, but, you know, there's tracks. I know track groups work with a couple of companies with that and tried it. Because they can be high enough and far enough behind the horses, they don't hear the little buzz. But again, you got to have good weather. When it rains, what do you do?
I think the overhead shot's been tremendous, and inquiries and things like that. When I say not during the race, there's nothing worse than, you know, watching a race and all of them, they switch up to up and then down and then left and then right. It's that's what I mean. It's an after the race. It's good for, but like inquiries are, it's fantastic when you can hover over and see what you can't see. Usually right when that camera switches and it's, you know, you don't get the right angle.
And I think, you know, to the point of also about data and what, you know, there's data that's important to the regular horse player, the hardened horse player. And then if we're trying to grow this for your sports wagers, your people that are betting on basketball and football and everything else, how to bet on horse racing, we have to simplify that because all this data means nothing to them. They can't understand it. It's not quick enough for them. They don't get it for free, things like that. So, you know, simplifying. But the camera angles, when they're watching, they're used to with their other sports. So they want to be able to see all those different angles and different views.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, almost would wish you could put a camera on every horse. So I bet the five, I want to watch the five from this angle. Or I bet the two, I want to, you know, that would be really nice for the fan.
Right.
And, you know, the thing is, guess what? You could do it tomorrow.
Yes, you could.
I mean, if you wanted to just do it and check it out. Maybe it's confusing. Maybe it would be not. But at least there's something that would be worth it. I'd think it would be very cool. Everyone's into the visual.
Exactly.
When they show they get lucky on the Kentucky Derby or the Oaks or something, they actually have a camera on the winner. And they show that I stop. I go, wait, I got to check this out. I don't ride horses. I don't know what it's like looking them between the ears and, you know, watching them go. So we need to get more creative and things like that.
100%.
And like Dick says, so they Do they have the? You say they do it electronically because does a from the chip in the saddle towel, you know.
Yeah.
But they. But then again, so if they you know all the tracks have underneath the track, they have readers and
we have GPS,
and however they do it, but
at every spot. But yeah, we need to take advantage of all the available technology, and that's a great way to try to grow the sport.
Yeah, I mean, and Sal brought something up too about workouts, which you know I never thought. You know, guy works some you know minute and two. Well, put the splits up.
Sure.
If
we can do
it. Company? Did he?
Yeah. Who did he run?
Was an exercise rider? Was it a jockey? Did he come from five behind and pass horses?
Yeah. I mean, we tape him now. We show him. But why not put the description down somewhere that the guy could look it up and like, okay, well, he went that last quarter and you know the last eighth and whatever he did and that workout becomes more than just you're trying to read into it yourself. Well, how's this trainer normally do? Oh, he has a bullet. This guy never has a bullet. Let's
information for the fans. Particularly first-time starters. I mean, we should do a better job with what we're presenting them.
Well, we used to. Well, let's put it this way: we used to have 20 years ago, there would be a horse, and they would have one start at some training center nobody ever heard of, and then he would whistle. It's like, what's going on here? That was only we didn't have that on the West Coast. That was in the East Coast. I remember seeing it. When I'd come out here. What's this CLQ? Oh, that's Larry's farm. It's over there. 38-2, and that's all you got. Right?
Yeah, the horse goes minute flat and wins by 10.
Exactly. Oh, but so we've improved on that. It always blew my mind. But we're heading there. We see what we need to do. We just need to get there.
And I'm going to circle back to the Central Racing Office. To me, one of the five or six officials left could sit with the clocker and maybe write the comments or get the fractions and put that together in the morning rather than taking entries there with the clocker. Now we have more data. That person has something to do.
Or, again, some of these young people coming along in this industry who really love the racing aspect of it, have that be part of their training. Sit up there with the clocker and write the comments, learn, watch, get the visual.
That's how you become better in the long run.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, again, we were all of the era that we got to do these other jobs, whether we worked on the track, with the horses, I've done the odds. I've done pretty much every racing official position, as did Rick. So when you get to that position, you have the respect of those people, but you also respect what they do.
Yeah.
Because you did it.
And being involved in so many areas, I grew up on the back of a horse. So I rode, I did the whole barn thing, and then got into the racing operations side, broadcast television, everything. And it was always, someone was asking me this last night, do you miss something? I said, no, I don't miss, any of X, Y, and Z. It's all been a great learning experience, and it was always something I always wanted to do, every part of this industry that you could do to learn it. And I think that's, again, I know I keep kind of harping on hopefully this younger generation, but to show them there are so many areas of this industry they can find a career path in.
And we have to provide that path.
Yes.
Because unfortunately, when they graduate, like from here, they have bills to pay, and they can't start on the bottom, per se, and get the apartment and move somewhere. They need, they need that path.
I mean, they're not going to live in a stall and attack room like I did.
No, they won't. Some of these probably would.
Well, thank you all for having me on.
Well, no.
And this is going to be a fantastic symposium. Really looking forward to it. I get to moderate. Very important subject, thoroughbred aftercare. So I'm looking forward to that one. And
we'll see you. I'll see
you shortly at the Racing Secretary Summit.
Yes.
Jill Byrne, everybody, and Colonial back for another.
How many days? 55?
44.
And the spring meet, the 3-day spring meet with the new
Virginia Derby. The reapplied,
50 points.
50 points. Vienna.
Both the Oaks is 50 points as well?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Virginia Oaks and Virginia Derby.
On the dirt.
Which will elevate the profile of the track as having a dirt program. There was a time when everybody thought there was only turf. They didn't even realize they had a dirt track.
Well, if you're going to run that time of year, you better have a derby prep, right?
Well, and I there are people that have made the point or have voiced the concern that that it kind of skews. It kind of skews things, but
it does.
But at the same time, they found the one, the one weekend in that point on the Derby Trail calendar that was an opening that was available as a prep opportunity.
Yeah. The only problem now is with these openings is horses, because they don't run as often.
They run less.
So even though we're trying to have one every other week or every week, these horses run every 5-6 weeks, so we have to realize that the circle now is bigger than it used to be.
It means there's another race that if you win, you don't have to race again until the first Saturday in May.
And then
that's what
they retire.
Yeah.
You finish 16th in the Derby, and you're like, okay, I'm done.
Yep, I got my win. I won my prep. But you know what I mean? It just thins out the field again when you're talking about it.
We'll see. There's also going to be horses that participate in it that run second and third and fourth that get some points that are going to run again.
True.
And you may get some horses, from the region, frankly, that, considering that, I mean, the only point opportunities really are New York, right? What other Eastern Seaboard, Northeastern opportunities, mid-Atlantic to Northeast opportunities are there?
There aren't.
Right?
Right.
Everything else is in Florida, California, Arkansas, and Louisiana.
Yeah, and it will give...
And Kentucky.
Hopefully it'll give Preakness another win and you're in.
There you go.
Because we always struggle with Preakness getting in the starters.
Yeah.
So here's a local horse, we assume, because it's on the East Coast. You should offer that horse a win and you're in.
Right. I have my own thoughts on the whole scheme, but I'll we talk about less is more. Now we have more with less. It just adds another race that
thins
the other races out.
My thought process
as a fan who's looking for these horses to run and like three preps, that's not happening. Hopefully they run in two. And now we've given another opportunity for a horse to run in one.
And they don't run against each other, so when it comes to Derby time and you're handicapping, none of these horses ran against each other. There's no rivalries that, in three races, one horse won two.
Well, wait a minute. Except that we got to the end of the year, and I have, we obviously launched right into conversation this morning, but Fierceness is going to be sidelined a little bit, at the very least a little bit, with ankle surgery that they described as over the weekend as elective surgery, chip and whatever else, and maybe cleaned some things up, but he won't be able to be ready for Pegasus. They're hoping to be able to run in Dubai or Saudi.
No, that's off the table. The point for the Met, hope to run.
You're right.
To get a prep for the Met.
You're exactly right. I'm sorry. In terms of a rivalry, you ended up generating when you folded in Sierra Leone and everything that, you got as much of an assembly of a rivalry ingredients as you could possibly want.
Well, they ran in the Remsen?
And
then?
Two. Drivers. Through all three, yeah.
No, but I'm talking about before the Derby. Talk about before the Derby. We're talking about leading up to the Derby. One goes here, one goes here, one goes here, one goes here, one goes here.
How is that?
It's just the way it's evolved. That's what I say. They're running as least as amount of time to get to the Derby.
When did Aladar and
they didn't either.
And Affirmed meet. I mean, they met as 2-year-olds. That's probably the best example. But Sunday Silence and Easy Goer.
Well, they're from different coasts.
I don't understand this argument.
It's not a bad thing. It's just giving a horse
you
a
think
reason.
It's a saturation.
Yes. I'm not necessarily rivalry saturation. It's just another place to run where I don't have to run again, maybe. You know, we're now at the point where you look up at the Derby. There's horses with, you know, three, four, five starts. That's it. And, you know, it's, you know, maybe I'm greedy. I just like to see horses run more. That's all. And when you take away opportunity, they have to run more. When you add opportunity, they can run less. That's basically what we're just talking about with the claimant horses or any of them.
Well, and I wanted to pull up the schedule. So in January, the Jerome and the Smarty Jones are run January 4th. The LeCompte is the 18th. And the Southwest is the 25th. Then we get into February, and Gulfstream, Holy Bull, February 1st, as well as the Bob Lewis and the Withers. Sam Davis, a week after the Holy Bull at Tampa. Risen Star is February 15th. Sunland Derby back on the schedule. The 16th of
February.
They
lost some points, though, right? They used to be 50.
Yeah, now it's a 20-point. It's earlier in the year. It's the 20-pointer. The Battaglia, which now is a 20-point race, on the also 22nd. The Rebel is the 22nd. And this is out of the country, Ireland and wherever else. Fountain of Youth, March 1st, with the Gotham and the San Felipe. That's traditional. A week later, the Tampa Bay Derby, then the Virginia Derby. The Jeff Ruby, the Louisiana Derby, the Arkansas Derby, the Florida Derby, then into April. I'm sorry. I don't see any complaint with this. I just don't.
I'm not complaining. I'm not complaining.
Flesh to put 10 horse fields in all this, though.
Well, field size hasn't been a problem in the prep on the prep front.
No, it's usually the three or four up along, and then the locals fill the card.
Well,
you know, it's. I like to see horses get beat and have to run again to get there. Not hit, run 1-2 and then sit on the fence until the first Saturday of May. I mean, you like to see a horse finish third or fourth, get in trouble in the big field, and then force them to run again to get in.
Well, Hammer. I have to agree with Hammer a little bit, but the real issue is the time between starts and the amount of starts horses make. And Steve and I do this thing during the year with Presque Isle Downs. And it's remarkable that the minute the season begins, no matter what the age and experience of the horses, many are 8, 9, 10 years old, they're running every 2-3 weeks. They're on at Topeka. They're coming out sound. They're going. It's just amazing to see. And so that business model works because the horses can come back so quickly, so it can keep field size where it is. But the minute you start going to 6 weeks, and I blame Charlie Whittingham because every trainer wanted to win a Group One off a long layoff, just like Charlie did. And now they all think they're Charlie Whittingham with the long layoffs and everything else. And it's just, it's frustrating because if you play sheets, even if you bounced, you still were going to come back and race. So it's not like you raced and then you know the optimum time is 6 weeks from now. You're going to race in between there. I might not just bet you in that time. I might wait for that race coming back 6 weeks later. So it's just... I don't see any change in that unless we have the therapeutic means of treating all the horses and taking care of all their ailments. And then we got the, you know, unfortunately, then we get out to the track and we got vet care and inspections, and that's become not controversial. No one's really against it, but that's a factor in getting horses into starting gates and keeping fields full. So...
No, but you bring up good points. Synthetics and turf horses generally can bounce back quicker.
Yes.
The dirt, it takes a little longer.
Let me go back to the Charlie Whittingham comment. Believe me, he would bring a horse in from parts unknown and run him in a race and run sixth, and then let him run in the grade one, you know, at a decent price. Larry Gilligan, a good friend and ex-rider that used to gallop for, he would tell a lot of stories about, you know, getting them ready.
But and I agree with what Sal was saying. Like, you want to see horses face each other, and losing is not the end of the world if the horse gains something from it and learns something from it and is in a different set of circumstances that that he hadn't been in. We're betting now. We're not really betting horses anymore. We're betting trainers.
You're right.
And we're betting people.
You're right.
Horse is just part of the people equation.
That's a good point.
So like we were just saying about some horse at so-and-so's backyard farm, well, none of that matters unless that trainer has a pattern of doing that. And that's where data helps and comes in handy. But it's just tough for me being in the game, watching the game as long as I have, and seeing the lack of frequency in terms of racing their horses, and six starts is a busy year, and 10's unheard of, stuff like that.
It's true. I mean, I always think back my days at Parks. I had one trainer and a son with five horses, and they probably averaged 25 starts a year with those five horses. And they would grind out a living at the bottom.
Yeah.
You know, those horses may earn $300,000, and they lived as a family, and that was fine. They never broke down.
No, which is something you could never do today. But you know, to run in a race at the end of the year, I would say if you haven't started six times, you can't run in this race. Heaven forbid you tried that. Now it's like, you know, oh, they forced me to run to get to this race. But we don't have any of those. I used to have a thing in my head when I was vote for the Clips thing. Four starts. You run four or less. I don't even care who you are. I don't vote for you because it's not a year long thing. And now half of them have run four or less, in a lot of the categories because they don't make the year. And, you know, you're looking at it's just the way it's changed. And, you know, people want to make sure they get to that race one way or another. And not necessarily, like Sal said, and not in the best shape. But if they get something going, we're in.
Yeah.
We made the gate. And with, the 20 horse gate, that's a big thing to get into that, to make that 20 that 20 spot.
That's for sure.
Well, Steve's shuffling papers frantically here as trees continue to die to handle his paper output, even when he travels.
I got no choice. What choice do I have?
I got no choice.
Exactly. I got nowhere else to go. Zach Mayo, folks. One thing we got to do, and we've gotten 2.5 hours in because there was immediately the Allen Foreman piece I wanted to get established early. But the weekend action, Rich Migliori couldn't join us, and Andy Serling probably tomorrow. Andy, of course, was in Jamaica for that Mutat Mile and had another phenomenal time. And actually, that management team, I'm going to try to get them on tomorrow or Wednesday. Oh, my gosh, I'm going to forget.
I read it.
Will they be here?
Yes. I know.
Nice guys.
It's not Sovereign. It begins with an S.
Yes. Solomon. Solomon?
No, I don't think
it's
so.
It's very similar. So we're going to try to get them on, which was Andy's suggestion. I appreciated it. But Rich Migliori will join us tomorrow, probably first thing in the early hours before anybody comes through here. But Saturday's action Todd Pletch, in terms of the trainer visits this week, I will try to have both Baffert and Pletcher they'll be here for their presentation, the Mark Kaufman workshop that they did a few years ago, and they're reprising. There's actually a few things going on here that are very little interesting. CNBC is going to be here to film the next couple of days, and the filmmaker, Moses? Don Moses? The guy that made The Big Short is going to be here. They want to do a Business of Racing. I don't know if it's a documentary or if it's just a feature. And here's Robert. Is this like an Arizona alumni badge? Wow. Wow. Let me see. Oh, that's very sharp. That's very, very nice to add to your collection
my pin
of
collection.
If you own the sports jacket, you could wear that.
Hey now,
you just wait. You just wait. We'll
break it out.
Another hour and a half.
Break it out.
Yeah, it'll be out.
I got one crumbled in my suitcase.
You will not find a tie in my many accessories anymore, but sport coat I still have.
Todd Pletcher, I'm anxious to talk to
him. I called him a couple weeks ago and asked him when he was coming. I was hoping to get him in the session.
Right,
where
before.
He gets in about 2 today, so he'll be here in the morning. He'll be here this afternoon, maybe. Right. But
so we'll,
be here this morning.
We'll grab Todd to talk about Locked. You know, we were all kind of lined up against Locked going into Friday. Just because, second off the layoff, and he was giving away a lot of recency. And he ran very well. I mean, it wasn't as if, I mean, he got a 101 buyer, and I guess to some degree, for instance, Andy, when he joins us, Andy said, I don't know, he said Mulliken, ran okay, post time, rallied okay. It wasn't precisionist or 49er in the Naira Mile or Cigar, but it's nice to have Locked back. I mean, just to have a 3-year-old that you know is going to be around for the 4-year-old season. And there's a lot of horses like this that'll emerge as the calendar continues.
Any word on Mindframe?
He's fine. He's moving forward.
He's looking. I think he's looking for Dubai-ish, okay.
Yes,
something like that.
That's exactly right. That I conflated those two. I'll tell you who you got to mention. He was fourth at 28-1. Coastal Mission. Jeff Runco. Runco does such a great job, and whether they're running on the bandbox at Charlestown, he brings them in, into New York. It just always shows up. I mean, he was beaten 4 lengths, but picked up the last major check, as they say. And so, nice job by Coastal Mission and Arnaldo Boca Chica. I tell you, Bookham Dano was really compromised by the inside draw. We say it. Oh, we'll have to work out a trip and have to overcome. But it's a hindrance.
Speaking of horses coming back on short rest, I meant to bring this up last week. It's a horse in Hong Kong named Healthy Healthy, and he won at Happy Valley on Wednesday, and he came back and won a Sha-Tin on Sunday.
How about
2 weeks ago. Because I do this report every week on a spreadsheet, and you type in HE and Excel pulls it up, and I'm like, wait a minute,
this horse just run.
Am I doing this right? Or what am I doing wrong here?
So he would have had to enter already, knowing he was going to run there, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, he would have already been entered, and he won. It didn't affect. I don't know if they re-handicapped him. Usually, when you win, you pick up 5-6 pounds. Not sure about that, but he won on Wednesday, and he won on Sunday.
Very cool. Well, we'll talk not only about
can be done.
100%.
Sure can.
We'll talk about Locked with Todd as well as Tizzy in the Sky. Nice win for the 5-year-old mare, taking the Gopher Wand. Was prominent, also drawn inside, and Pratt had her well positioned. Occult took all the money and went off just under even money. I thought this was a very tricky race, and I ended up using a bunch of them to try to, get something. I did not have a great set of opinions on Saturday.
Well, I guess you can use this time to say congratulations to Flavien Pratt for breaking.
That's true.
Breaking the stakes and graded stakes.
Jerry Bailey's record and IRAD's records. True.
Tremendous. And starting out in California for many years under Derek Lawson as his agent there, well, maybe that'll be a trivia question in 20 years as Dick Allen was. But he being out in California, he would just learned how to ride with some really good riders. And I think he always knew that if he wanted to you know, reach that level and get those kind of numbers, he had to venture on. And Brad Pegram's his agent now, and had Mike Smith, and still has Mike Smith. Kind of knew the ropes a little bit back there, and was able to accomplish that. When you get down to this point, and that I think about a couple months ago, I think they saw that was in play. So he was flying around all over the place, which is what you had to do. I remember back when Mike Smith at the Meadowlands time was trying to break, I don't know whose record it was, and Steve Adika was Mike's agent then, and he would call over, "Who's in the race? Who's in the race? Who can I take off? Who can I bump? Who can I bump?" And he would come over, and he'd put Mike on these little overnight stakes that we had, and back in the day,
no jock agent elicits more guffaws and smiles and eye rolls than Steve Adika, the. One of the great characters amongst so many.
You want a car? I'll get you a car. Meet me in the corner.
Adika
with the agents, because the agents really are part of the game.
But what's sad is because of COVID.
I know.
And the Zoom.
We talked about that.
Right. It changed everything. Yeah. It's they're less a part of the scene.
Yeah.
And that's what we mentioned earlier about the personnel, having the people around has just been COVID kind of put an exclamation mark on that.
Really did.
Usually, like myself, I would befriend a few of them to get calls and stuff. Get calls from the agents.
Oh, they
rather than bother the trainers, they let me know, and they would come ahead. In 2 weeks, so and so wants to come for this race. Star it, whatever,
They gave you information that you couldn't get anywhere else. Hey, I just thought, talk to so-and-so.
At Parks, I had agents, for Chad Brown and Babe Dutrow, and those guys would come and run at Parks. But these agents local would let me know he could help you out in there, or he's pointing to this race for you.
Always.
And that, for me, I'm at Parks. Those are big names to put on the card for my fans.
Yeah. So try and make those the races. Racing office loses that little connection where a guy would go, "Look, hey, if this race goes, so-and-so's going in it." It's like, why don't they go in now? I never understood that. But at least you knew you had another horse, which you wouldn't know.
So make this one, he has another one for you for that race.
Yeah, they knew what was going on and who had calls and who didn't. And so you miss that interaction. I mean, it goes on as a little bit more, but they're not sitting there in your office kind of feeding you. And we ate better with them around, too.
Yeah. But it kind of streamlined it, though, because those ones came in and gave you your extras for the three or four trainers that they deal with. So you didn't have three or four trainers coming to you at one agent. And that kind of stuff is good.
A couple of other notes from the weekend. We still got to talk to Brad Cox, and actually I'm glad we never connected with Brad last week, because Mohima, I kept talking all during the week leading up, trying to figure out a way to beat Mohima, and she ran well, and it was a fast race, and Chad Brown's that Ballerina Doro, a lot of the angles that we discussed during the handicapping process about the two-year-olds, some making the move from turf to dirt, like Ballerina, and she ran very well.
Didn't they win two?
Oh yeah, yeah. And 9-1, almost 10-1 on Chad. With 2-5 on Mohima, and Mohima, Farange Giroux had to motivate her all the way down the stretch. I mean, the Ballerina came at her and absolutely, harassed her to the wire. So Mohima, the Munnings filly, and boy, the situation with Godolphin and the two-year-olds is scary, because of course, a half an hour earlier, as suggested, Owen Hardy, Born Again Hard. Whatever he said to Michael Banahan at Godolphin to get some better Godolphin stock.
You got it.
He's got some better Godolphin stock.
Yeah, the Blue Coats. They're loaded.
Well, Poster made this transition.
He's the one who ran come from the turf, right?
So did Ballerina Doro. Poster, though, Chad was getting to Poster with Aviator Gee at another jump, not even another jump. Aviator Gee wins that race, and I know a lot that horse was also 10-1.
So if you read the the note on Aviator Guy, I bet it basically says that he had a rough trip or green trip.
He waited. There was a point where Manny Franco basically had to
make a
wait
decision.
He had to wait for an opening. Aviator Guy, I tell you, the big disappointment here, obviously, was Key Wade. And maybe the people that made him 107-1 in that future book weren't wrong. I mean, I was all excited, and I don't think there's a lot to build on after that effort. So Key Wade really and Studley Do Right, they end up fifth and fourth in here. But Owen Hardy, back to back weekends with Fairpoint and now Poster. So good for Owen. Elsewhere, let's also get in some of the other weekend results. Good start, it seems, to Oaklawn's season.
Mm-hmm.
For everything I could see, you had a bonanza on Friday in the they had the cross country, and you ended up with a close to a $30,000 payday in the cross country on Friday. The two Oaklawn stake winners, you had Peter Miller and Ramon Vasquez rode both the stake wins over the weekend. He had Kale's Angel in the Advent on Friday, opening day, the Complexity, and then Happy as a Choice. Nice job by Scully. Scully gave out at least three winners, not big prices per se. Happy as a Choice got that, and there was somebody else that I'll come up with Scully had, I think, a $12, an $11, a couple of other nice winners.
In other words, he's normal.
Yeah,
he's the win machine. He really is. He does a great job.
Yes, he does. But where is it? Here it is. There was, that was me, actually. that was me and Laurel. That horse of Bobby Bales, Robbie Bales' horse, Next Girl. Paid $11.60. Took a little bit of money. That was in that allowance leading up to the two stakes. And Tony Eclipse for Brittany Russell won the boys' race. And Cal Lynch.
My trainer, Cal Lynch. You were second in the boys' race as well. He had a good day, Cal Lynch.
Yeah. Listen, Cal Lynch does a very good job. And
Caprice is
Saxton,
five
right?
Out of Saxton, six.
Yeah. Caprice is 5 out of 6.
Philly. He's done a good job with her. He does a good job in my Philly.
Well,
hopefully we can get her there too.
Well, that Tony Eclipse. This looks like a nice. This is a nice one for Stuart Grant. Not this time. A homebred out of a Tappet mare. Boy, it was a big weekend for Tappet mares. And I must have seen six Tappet mares that had stake wins over the weekend. It was crazy, and maiden winners as well. As if he hasn't done enough, with his direct winners. How about down at Brian Lynch and looking Brian forward Lynch. To catching up with Lynchy. He swept the two stakes down at Tampa. Donut God wired that field in the inaugural. With Sammy Camacho and Mrs. Worldwide, Flying Dutchman Breeding and Racing. And this was a global campaign filly. And, in fact, I wonder, take a quick glance here, because, of course, global campaign, first crop sire, and third stake winner now for global campaign. And, of course, global campaign not Stanhoff Mike oh my gosh Michael oh come on, what is wrong with me? Came back out of his semi-retired and he came back to train. Oh my God! I tell you that this is the first sign post 65.
Well, it happens. It happens.
Hushin, Mike Hushin. Jesus. Wait, Mike. That's back to back stake wins for Mrs. Worldwide as well. Up at Woodbine, you had the Valedictory and
beautiful
Iron Horse, and the slew of partners involved, Black Ridge, Saratoga 7, etc. The veteran gets Stormy, 7-year-old gets Smokin, who of course last year, 2023 winner at.
Did you get the dress code?
At Kentucky Downs.
Yeah.
Gets Smokin, wins the valedictory.
That's the Cassie horse, right?
Correct.
Yes.
And there was one. Oh, there was one other Tampa note that caught my eye. Just because the Raiders split this weekend with Cornell, and it caught my eye that Brent Lau, who names a lot of his horses, a Cornell grad, and Brent Lau, innately good. This came in the maiden race that was between the stakes at Tampa, and his mare, Cayuga's Waters. And, of course, any mention of Cayuga's Waters requires the famed poem.
Calabunga? I don't know.
High above Cayuga's Waters, there's an awful smell. Some say it's Cayuga's Waters. We say it's Cornell. The classic. But Brant's mare, Cayuga's Waters, produced this Good Samaritan colt, 45-1. So great job. Nice job by. I had to slip that in.
I didn't get a chance to write that down. Maybe that's good.
The other winner of. Another of the winners of James's. He liked at Fairgrounds on Saturday. He liked Think Big. But Think Big took money a little bit, 5-2, almost 3-1. So that was a nice, another nice one from James, and that gets us to Baffert. And I tell you, you know, you've heard Baffert over the years with me in particular, you know, explaining how it for him it's a touch and feel about running horses, literally leading up to entry day. Well, Tenma was a filly that he really backed off. In fact, when I had asked him well in advance of Breeders' Cup, you know, how you were shaping up, he said, I'm going to give her more time. And here, you know, she obviously benefited and ran very well Saturday, winning the Starlet. He's won the Starlet 8 straight years.
Yeah, we mentioned 7. He was an idiot for picking against him the other. He took the blinkers off this one. He took the blinkers off another filly in there as well. And, you know, she just won. Anyway, anytime you see his number one guy on there, Juan Hernandez, it gives you a little bit of a tip-off. And a square price, you know, $7. Like you said, 8 times in a row, please. It's just
it's crazy. It's incredible. It is incredible. Those were, I think that's...
So but before we finish up,
go ahead.
I want to hit the Monday crowd up for the calendar.
Yes.
So we are at that time of year where we give away calendars, and we ask you to do a small task. Santa Anita is back in the calendar mode here. So although they give you can come to Santa Anita, please do for the day after Christmas to pick up your calendar. But if you're not local and you would like a Santa Anita calendar, we've been doing this for about 15 years now on the show, and we ask you to do one small thing, and this year we're asking you to send in a picture of a sunset. Not too tough. If you look, you probably have one on your phone right now. But if not, you've got about
a couple of weeks.
Couple weeks left to find a sunset somewhere. But send it in. A little comment about the show. Include your name, of course, and please include your address, because it's tough to mail without an address. I'll usually try and I'll catch it. I'll get back to you. But send the picture of the sunset. You know, like I said, a little comment about the show, a little story about the sunset, whatever. You know, as little or as long as you write. And I really enjoy the comments and reading them. So send that in to santaanitacalendar@yahoo.com. And that's as simple as that. And we'll get a calendar out to you.
And do you want to talk about a segue, a setup?
I guess we're there. Do it. We got a winner.
Who won
sunset calendar?
Who won the Golden Gate debutante.
Sunset Calendar.
Sunset Grazin.
There you go.
Huh? You can't make it up. Sunset Grazin for Sam Calvario.
You know what? I got a great picture someone sent in. I forget who it was, the name. And it was a picture of a winning a horse blanket draped over a sawhorse at the barn.
Yeah.
And he goes, "Well, this is a picture of the sun setting on my winning day." And I said, "You know what? I like it.
All right, that
it
works.
Was very clever." I said, that works.
That does work.
I was looking for a reflection or something, and I didn't even explain it. I said, I like it.
I will send out. I promise to put that picture behind the back of the Chris Katulak from Grand Island, of course. A couple of others from the weekend. The horse at Turfway, Finster, that was 6-1. James also gave out Finster. For Saturday, actually took money, went down to 2-1, and I haven't mentioned one of the longest, if not the longest stakes, certainly the longest price among the stakes winners over the weekend. How about your man Joe O?
Oh, love that, right?
Joe Orsino in the 2-mile Allen Jerkins, and sometimes you don't know you've got a 2-mile horse until you get a chance to run a horse 2 miles. And that was certainly the case with Lord Eddard Stark, the He's Had Enough 6-year-old gelding with Louis Reyes, or is that Lionel Reyes? And 60-1. 60-1 winning the Jerkins. And of course, look, the gray wizard ended up scratching. Graham Motion took him out. But still. Not just the longest shot on the board. I mean, by a wide margin. Yeah. The next price was 45-1.
Who knew?
Too funny. Lord Eddard Stark. And, I mean, I went back and looked at the PPs. And, I mean, this is a horse that, a four-time winner, made $165,000. You know, it was obviously a nice horse. A homebred by John Rowe. So congratulations to him. And, you know, had gone, I think, as far as 1 1/8 miles, and now suddenly you realize this is a horse that
can run all day.
Yeah, that could have been running in the Lawrence Realization, and you know, this is a horse that wishes it was born in 1920. it's crazy. You just don't know.
No, we don't run those races enough.
The idea that, you know, typically a jock comes back in the morning, an exercise boy comes back and says, "Boss, this horse doesn't get tired."
Right.
And that's when you go look for races like the 2-mile Allen Jerkins. Well, coming to you from Tucson tomorrow and Wednesday. Then we'll move shift tack to Remington for the Springboard Mile. Speaking of Derby points, moving on to Oklahoma City on Wednesday night. But back tomorrow, of course. Want to thank Hammer and Dick, of course, back with us tomorrow. Sal Sinatra for an extended visit, and Alan Foreman filling in a lot of blanks this morning, the first half of the show. Jill Byrne stopped by as well. Eric Hamelbeck, he'll be with us more tomorrow, as well as many other industry types. Replay 6 to 9 here on SiriusXM Archive Podcast after some post-production by Brian. Enjoy your day. Good luck if you're playing, everybody. Talk to you tomorrow from Tucson, the University of Arizona Symposium on Racing.
Breaking down the biggest stories in the world of horse racing. This is At the Races with Steve Bick on SiriusXM Radio.